You know where your nearest defibrillator is.
Stay clear.
And clear. Press the flashing orange button now. Shock delivered. Begin CPR now.
Plus, how dry is it in New South Wales?
It's extremely dry. There's no grass on the paddocks and the old gum trees are all starting to wither.
Simon called us at the airport talking about this for some reason.
Computed tomography.
And look who Bethany Bell's with.
I'm with Gerhard Lobner from Met am Fahrplatz.
With the BBC News Now, Charles Carroll.
Criticism of Boris Johnson is intensifying following comments he made about burqas worn by some Muslim women.
Willingness to defy her now, a signal of further clashes to come.
Jessica Parker reporting. Millions of British gas customers who endured a price increase earlier this year have been told there's another one in the pipeline. Claire Barrett is personal finance editor at the Financial Times. And if there's a better personal finance editor in this country, I'd like to know who it is. Now, Claire, what's happening with this increase?
Well, as you said, a double whammy for British gas customers. About 3.5 million of them have found out today that from the 1st of October, their annual energy bills are going to rise by an average of £44 a year. That's because the standard variable tariff, remember, if ever a company uses the word standard, it's not its best deal. If you're on that, you're going to see your bills rise by about 3.8% from October, equating to about £44 a year. Now, people are really angry about this because although British Gas isn't the first energy company to raise its prices more than once this year, there is precedent, it's the UK's biggest energy supplier. So its decision to put up prices for the second time this year is going to affect a lot of customers.
What about the reasoning put forward by British Gas? Was this unforeseeable? Are all the people who are now going to have to pay more, having already dipped into their pockets this year, was there no way British Gas could have known this was coming?
Well, British Gas's own Centrica, if you read the financial pages, they had results last month and the chief executive signalled then that a price rise, a second price rise, was likely because of the amount of money that the company is having to pay to acquire the energy in the wholesale market that it then sells on to its own customers. Now, this isn't a problem exclusive to British Gas. The oil price is going up around the world and that is impacting gas prices. So nearly all of the big energy companies have lifted their prices this year. And even Ofgem, the energy regulator, said yesterday that it would also increase the level of the price cap that's coming in later this year in October to freeze the bills of very vulnerable customers. So it's the wholesale markets which the companies are using as their excuse. British Gas said today that the price increase that it's seeing in the wholesale market is around 20% and saying by only putting a 3.8% rise onto its customers on top of a 5.5% increase in April, it's doing the best that it can to keep prices down.
That business of shopping around and certainly getting off the standard variable rate. Speaking to a colleague today who has shopped around quite a bit in response to items like this on PM, she said, well, the trouble is I shop around and then the people I go to, they put the prices up.
Absolutely. And this is why I think that energy switching is a broken model for Britain. If you do switch to a tariff, now remember this price rise that British Gas is flagging today, if you've done a deal to go on a fixed rate, then you'll be protected from the rise. It's only the customers who are on a floating rate who are going to see that increase come in October. But even so, you have to take the initiative to move. Once you've rolled off a fixed price deal with one energy supplier, if it runs out, then you have to find another one. Otherwise, your bills are going to go up in the meantime. So you really have to keep on top of this. And if you're perhaps, without being ageist, if you're an older person, you're less confident with IT, maybe it's worth phoning your parents tonight, frankly, if
Wait
they're
a minute.
British
if you're,
Gas
if
customer.
If you're an older person, phone your parents.
Or if you have an older person in your life, like your parents, in my case, that's always what I do when I hear when these big energy changes are coming, because it's easy for me to switch my bills, although it's a hassle, it's just something I have to remember to do. But for a lot of people, going online and using a comparison website, although it's not rocket science, if they're not used to doing that kind of thing every day, they are the ones who are more likely to be stuck on the expensive tariff that is the thing that goes up whenever a company like British Gas puts up its prices.
Always good to hear from you. Claire Barrett, personal finance editor at the Financial Times. 5:14, an update from Charles.
There's been more criticism of Boris Johnson as the former Foreign Secretary.
Daniela Ralph reporting from Amiens. It's one of the busiest travel weekends of the year at British airports. I've no idea whether that's true, I just enjoy saying it. Whenever you fly, there's the ritual of getting liquids and gels up to a certain size out of your luggage, put into a see-through bag of a certain size, so the security machines can check it. You know, it's 12 years since those rules about liquids were introduced. Will they be with us forever? Simon Calder, the travel editor of The Independent, investigates, beginning at one of the Gulf aviation hubs.
Known and unknown.
Simon Calder from The Independent. Now, we've talked many times in the programme, in fact, just recently, about Amazon, which seems to want to get its finger into every pie available. Well, according to The Times today, Amazon is about to have a go at changing our accents. The paper says Amazon has applied for a patent for technology to detect the origins of two people in a phone call and adjust their speech so that each hears the other in his or her own accent. The Times, this is how it'll work, apparently. The speech of both parties in a call would be analysed in the first seconds of a conversation and compared with Amazon's reference samples to identify their respective accents. The patent claims that an accent translation model could then convert the speech heard by both parties into their own accents by altering audio characteristics such as pitch, melody, and amplitude. Now, obviously, we wish Amazon well, and we don't want to contradict them, especially not now. But we rather like, here at PM, the different accents from around the UK. We want to hear them. We're going to hear them now. Here's a selection from Melvyn Bragg's Radio 4 programme, Roots of English.
Before we give you the sounds and sentences which are printed in large, heavy type in your book, we shall tell you what elocution means. Elocution means speaking out clearly. Good elocution means that one should not only be heard and understood, but that all the warmth and kindness of the personality should be conveyed by language and diction.
Accent is settled, first of all, by class. No much doubt about that. Second, it's determined also by district, by region, by area where you live, so that the public schoolboy from, say, the northeast coast, or York even, public schools there, their accents are educated Yorkshire. It's a funny old hybrid, but they know they can't say Eba and Gum or anything like that. But we were the respectable working class. We spoke Yorkshire.
I think when you get into the swing of things here and you're working on the phones, you try to talk a little bit different.
I think a lot of people will perceive it as being, if it sounds sort of quite broad, possibly common.
I thought I sounded common, you know, but some people do like the Geordie accent.
A lot of people think, oh God, daft Geordies, we don't want to talk to them.
I've got an aunt who is a very upper English and she likes you to speak properly, you know. You must speak properly because she lived in London for a lot of years and she likes to talk proper English.
I've got two young children and my mum's always on about, oh, don't say it like that, don't say it like this. But sort of local dialect slang words, which everybody's got. People need that and I think you need, as part of your accent, you recognise where you're from. You know, if you're from Birmingham, Liverpool, Glasgow, wherever you're from, you should always be very, very proud of the way you speak.
But the people here have got that kind of, they're feisty, you know. That's why people here have a terrible difficulty with the word compromise. I mean, no surrender, not an inch. Those are the words that actually drive a lot of the political action here. So the word compromise doesn't fit easily in there. You know, if the whole idea, the whole basis of your beliefs are that you will not surrender and that you will not give an inch, the very idea of you talking to someone to try and work something out seems redundant.
I was a kettle boy. Well, I left school 14 up Cockspur and I used to boil the kettle and warm the pasties. I used to know all the pasties, all the makes, all the men's pasties, different types, and well, all different shapes, different crimping on the top, and, you know, I used to know them all. Some would come early, 5 o'clock. Of course, they'd be having their crib at 8 o'clock. Then I'd have to warm their pasties up, and then the others come in 7 o'clock. They'd probably have their crib at 10, something like that. I'd be warming their pasties up, you know, and then some would rather have it dinner time and warm their pasties up for that.
Welsh English certainly comes in many varieties, some of them very historical, particularly those varieties that have been spoken in the traditional marches.
I think people feel there's something to do with the London accent or the Essex accent, Cockney, that it's a lazy accent, that you drop words and letters, but not necessarily. I just think maybe people don't like the sound of it as much. I'm not too bothered what people really think, but I think when it's in a professional sense, you should try and talk properly, just because people can't always understand you if you've got too much of an accent. but I don't feel you need to try and be someone who you're not.
I was born other side Lanvercranian and moved down when I was to Pulkey when I was two, and my father and mother are real Welsh, but none of us five children, we all spoke English.
Some of the voices from Roots of English on Radio 4 with Melvin Bragg. We'll have more after these messages.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates the actor, writer, director, comedian, teacher and parent
at being in 15.
The time now is 5:32. This is PM. I'm Eddie Mayer. Charles Carroll has the BBC News.
The former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, has joined the senior Conservative poll at 29 cents, and against the euro, it's at 1 euro and 11 cents, which makes the euro worth 90.1 pence.
Thank you, Charles Carroll, 25 to 6. However dry the weather has been in the UK this summer, it's been lush here compared to New South Wales in Australia. The entire state is in drought. Farmers are struggling to feed livestock. Some are said to have been forced to shoot starving cattle. New South Wales produces around a quarter of Australia's agricultural output. Will Chalk from BBC Radio 1's Newsbeat has been hearing from two farmers.
Hi, I'm Russell. I'm a farmer in Australia and I'm sitting here having a beer.
We've got to go and get another six-pack because we've run out. Good luck to you all in England.
Will Chalk from Radio 1's Newsbeat with that report. In Hollywood, Oscar is king, and there are big changes coming to the Academy Awards in the not-too-distant future. They've just been announced. Caroline Frost is an entertainment commentator. What are the changes, Caroline?
Hello, Eddie. Well, as you say, yes, these changes have just been announced today. The Academy, in a clearly a desperate attempt to stave off the increasing decline in ratings, people tuning in to watch the Oscars, they have come up with three quite groundbreaking suggestions. They're shortening the ceremony. They're guaranteeing it will be limited to a mere 3 hours.
Oh, come on. They always say that.
Well, you know, on paper at least, they won't be televising every single award. They'll be slightly creating a two-tier system, what's worth televising, what isn't. They will be moving the award season up from next to the ceremony 1 year after next year, so that it doesn't come so late in the season, because they feel that it's become a bit of an anticlimax. We're all a bit award season weary, so it'll be going earlier in the season. Plus, possibly the most interesting thing, they're creating a brand new category for an outstanding achievement in a popular film.
Have they done that because in recent years they've given big Oscars to some less popular films?
Exactly. I mean, I've been looking through the charts, and you'd have to go all the way back to 2003 and The Return of the King, the final Lord of the Rings film, to see where the critics actually married up with what cinema goers were wanting to watch. Ever since then, we've seen all sorts of amazing films still gracing the cinema, but nothing that actually turns up at award ceremony. Once you get to award season, you get a bunch of films that often people, certainly in this country, where they're released later and later, haven't seen. And it's probably the much the same for American sort of standard cinema goers. So they're desperate to get people the likes of Black Panther, Deadpool, all the films that people actually go to see. They want to get those stars at the ceremony, hoping that the fans will join them there.
And do you think this will make a difference?
Well, I mean, I think the bigger problem that the cinema industry is facing is that these huge tentpole movies are holding up the entire industry. Like I said, the R-Men's, the X-Men's, and these aren't the ones getting official recognition, because what's happening is that actors, writers, directors are all joining a mass exodus to the small screen, where the quality, the ambition, originality and ratings are all continuing to flourish. And that, I don't think, is necessarily going to be something that's solvable by overhauling one ceremony, however radical those changes may be.
Caroline, thank you. Caroline Frost, entertainment commentator, 19 minutes to 6. Last Friday, the Canadian government sent out a tweet condemning the arrests of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Foreign Ministry called the statement a major, unacceptable affront to the kingdom's laws and judicial process. Relations between Canada and Saudi have worsened since. On Monday, Saudi's foreign ministry recalled its ambassador to Canada for consultations and declared the Canadian ambassador persona non grata, giving him 24 hours to get out. It froze all new trade with Canada and ordered thousands of Saudi students studying in Canada to come home or complete their study in other countries. Saudi Arabia's state airline cancelled all direct flights to Toronto. Canada's response? We're not backing down. Thomas Junot is a professor at the University of Ottawa's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. What do you make of Canada's stance? Tell us more about the people they're speaking up for.
Well, Canada, the two famous tweets that you referred to on late last week called for the release of human rights activists. One of them in particular has been referred to a lot. Her name is Samar Badawi. She is a women's rights activist in Saudi Arabia. She garners a lot of attention here in Canada because her brother, Raif Badawi, is a blogger, a liberal blogger, has been in jail in Saudi Arabia for a number of years now. Mr. Badawi does not have Canadian citizenship, but his wife and children have been living in Quebec here in Canada for a number of years now and actually obtained Canadian citizenship recently. So because of that connection, there's always been a bit more attention in Canada in domestic politics, but also in foreign policy towards the issue of human rights in Saudi Arabia, and a bit more attention than you would normally expect, given the limited importance of the bilateral relationship, more generally speaking.
And in terms of public discourse, how are Canadians reacting to what the government's done and the Saudi government response?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly how the Canadian public is reacting, since there haven't been, you know, polls or anything more systematic in the last 3 days to really measure that. But anecdotally, I would say that one part of the reaction is a bit of puzzlement and head scratching. Right? We're Canada. We're a very quiet country. We are not used to controversies at all. We are not used at all, like a lot of other countries are, to being engaged in disputes like that, to seeing another country react so harshly. So for a lot of people in Canada who don't follow the news on a day-to-day basis, this is a bit of a surprise, and I hesitate to use the word shock because that's a bit too strong, but people are, you know, scratching their heads a bit.
Has there been much international support from Canada's friends and allies for what it's done?
There has not been. There really has not been any international support. The most important international support that we would normally expect is from the U.S., but the word normal obviously does not apply since President Trump has been in power. The U.S. clearly said earlier this week that it did not want to get involved in the dispute. President Trump has a very warm relationship with the royal family and has clearly told them that human rights are just not a priority for him. So not getting support from the U.S. is disappointing. It's important for the Canada in the bigger picture, but right now it's not a surprise because we wouldn't expect it from this president. From the Europeans, we're still waiting for the European position to clarify as the week progresses, but so far the reaction has been very muted. Some people in Canada are increasingly disappointed by that, but as a somewhat more cynical observer of international politics myself, I'm not really surprised in the sense that it's not to say that the Europeans are in the process of dismissing Canada as a close ally. They are not. But they understand rationally, with different countries having somewhat different calculus, that for them to get involved in the dispute on the side of Canada would just not be a winning strategy. There's nothing to gain for them to lose points, if you want, to annoy Saudi Arabia, especially with Saudi Arabia being so enraged and reckless right now and unpredictable. So for Europeans to mostly lay low and avoid the controversy, personally, I don't really find it disappointing. And ideally, they would support us, but that they don't is pretty much to be expected.
Does Canada sell many arms to Saudi Arabia?
Over the years, Canada has sold a number of weapons deals to Saudi Arabia. There have been light armored vehicles and other lighter weapons in the low billions of dollars or the hundreds of billions of dollars, depending on which weapons packages we're talking about. Some of these weapons have been used by Saudi Arabia to repress human rights in its eastern Shia province, in Bahrain, probably in Yemen too. So that has always added an element of controversy in our country, and that has always made it difficult for Canadian governments, especially the current one under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who is really trying to brand itself as a feminist government, as a progressive government. The fact that we still do sell weapons to Saudi Arabia ties its hands, right, in terms of the fear of bringing any attention to this relationship.
Professor, thank you. Thomas Juneau. 5:46, Charles has an update.
The former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, is the latest senior Conservative to criticise Boris.
If you like wine, we have something for you in just a moment or two. First, defibrillators. They're a bit like toilets in that you don't worry too much about where your nearest one is until you really, really need it. The NHS, the British Heart Foundation and Microsoft have started a scheme to map out all the UK's defibrillators in the hope of reducing the number of deaths from cardiac arrests. There are tens of thousands of defibrillators available in offices, railway stations, leisure centres and other public places. But how easy is it to use them? Sarah Askew is head of survival from the British Heart Foundation, so you can help us. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Now, tell me about the kit you've got there.
So I've brought a defibrillator with me. So most of them, obviously, this is just one. All of them are very similar. I'm going to turn it on, if that's okay
yes,
with
by
you.
By all means. Will it make a noise?
It should make a noise, yeah, and it will talk to you. The thing about defibrillators is they talk to you, right. So they tell you
call emergency medical services now.
So it's telling you dial 999.
Follow the voice prompt calmly. So, remove all clothing from chest and stomach. Rip clothing if necessary.
There's scissors in the box that the defibrillator's in, so you can
take
cut the clothing
out the pads
if you need
from
to.
The bottom of the device.
All right. Let's hear from you rather than chew for a moment. But
I'll just turn the system
down.
Off.
So if someone's having a cardiac arrest in yep. front of you and you've got no training at all, will this guide you through helping the person?
Absolutely. You don't need to be trained to do, use a defibrillator. We would like everybody to know how to do CPR. The first thing to do is dial 999. Mm. The 999 operator will coach you through what to do. Start chest compressions. That's the most important thing to do. And then the operator on the phone will know if there's a defibrillator mapped on their system for the ambulance service nearby, and they'll send hopefully the other bystander or someone else to go and get the defibrillator. If you're the person getting the defibrillator, the moment, as you can see, that you take it out of the box and turn it on, it starts talking to you. It tells you what to do. You don't need training to use defibrillators. And there are some videos available that you can look online so that you can familiarise yourself. But actually, anyone can use a defibrillator.
How do we find out where our nearest one is?
So what we're trying to do is create a national network for the ambulance services, because it's the ambulance services that respond to the call. So it's them that need to know where the defibrillator is. And what we'd say to the public is, if there's one in your village, on your church hall or in your leisure centre, then it's good to know that that's there, because then you can always be the person that says there's a defibrillator located here. But what's essential is that we make sure that the ambulance service are able to direct people to their nearest defibrillator.
And these save lives.
These save lives, yeah. If you perform CPR and use a defibrillator, you can double the chance of someone surviving an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So they really do save lives. So it's important that people understand the chain of survival about dialing the emergency services, starting chest compressions, and then hopefully someone else going and getting the defibrillator and bringing it and using the defibrillator. At the moment, less than 3% of public access defibrillators are used in an emergency situation. So we just want the public to feel confident that if there is a defib there, open the box, it will talk to you and start using it.
I'm not quite sure what that statistic means, that 3%. Does that mean when people are having a cardiac arrest, there's a defibrillator nearby, but it's not being used?
Absolutely, because right. The public aren't using them because they think you need to be trained in it, or that they can't use it, or they're fearful that, like you said to me earlier, about if I was to put this onto you now, would
Well,
it,
I thought
would
you might have put it onto Charles Carroll and you know, but it's gone now.
It's so gone.
That moment's passed, but
if I put those pads on now, the defibrillator does a reading of the heart, and so it knows if the heart needs a shock or not. If it doesn't need a shock, it will not deliver that shock. So if you put, you can't hurt someone by using a defibrillator. That's the important thing to understand, is it will not deliver a shock if no one needs, if the person doesn't need a shock.
But worth having a look online, looking at the videos, just because you never know.
Absolutely. The British Heart Foundation has lots of videos online that people can have a look at to see about the defibrillator. If you've got one in your workplace or your school or wherever you're located, then make sure you're familiar with it. Have a look at those videos. Lots of all the other first aid charities have great resources as well for people to understand more.
And how do you know if it's a cardiac arrest someone's having? Because presumably you don't want to attach this if they're having something else.
Yeah, so a cardiac arrest, there's a difference between a cardiac arrest and a heart attack. And that's, I think, where a lot of people, there is a lot of misconception. So a cardiac arrest is someone is unconscious, their heart stopped beating and they're not breathing. So there is no output, there is nothing. So that person has collapsed in front of you. So my advice is step in and do something rather than do nothing.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Sarah
Thank
Askew,
you.
Head of Survival from the British Heart Foundation. That's a great title.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me onto the show.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
We know from some listeners that the start of PM at 5 is wine o'clock. For many in the production team, it's much earlier. If you do drink wine, Perhaps you've been avoiding Austria's efforts in recent years. There was that trouble with antifreeze in some Austrian wines back in the 1980s, and the whole industry there almost collapsed as a result, as you can imagine. The scandal forced a rethink of Austrian winemaking techniques, and it seems to have worked. The wine writer Jancis Robinson says Austria is the best-kept secret in the wine world. I should warn you, Bethany Bell's report from Vienna begins with, well, you'll hear for yourself.
It must be a piece of heaven, the old song goes.
Bethany Bell reporting. Now, Helen Willits with your weather. Hello.
Eddie, thank you. Hello there. Good evening. A far more comfortable 25 degrees at to the west.
Helen, thank you. On Monday, after an archive recording of Morecambe and Wise was discovered after more than 50 years, we played a small selection of their best bits and ended the programme with Bring Me Sunshine. Well, many listeners told us how much they enjoyed it, including Greg, who wrote in, I think he's a country and western fan. Greg advised we listen to the version of the song recorded by Willie Nelson. All right then.
Bring me sunshine.
Bring me love.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. This is Zeb Soans. Good evening. A former Attorney General has launched an outspoken attack on Boris Johnson in the wake of his comments about Muslim women who wear the burqa. Dominic Grieve said...